This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In making his case for regime change in Baghdad, President Bush frequently talks about the benefits of freedom and democracy, and not just for the people of Iraq. President Bush says he hopes democratic reforms will take root in Iraq and spread across the Middle East. It's an ambitious vision, and there are plenty of critics who point out the risks. Some argue that democracy can't be imposed from the outside, but others reply that the removal of a tyrant can allow democratic institutions to develop and thrive. So how exactly do you do that? Are there universal democratic principles that people of all nations can agree on? What are the institutions, the practices, the values that make up a democratic system? And what obstacles would the citizens of Iraq or other countries face as they try to build both the systems and the trust that democracy demands? Join the conversation. What do you think are the core principles of democracy? Have you ever worked in a country in transition to democracy? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us here in Studio 3A is Heba El Shazly. She's with the National Democratic Institute for International Affairs, where she's Deputy Regional Director for the Middle East and North Africa. Her organization develops programs to help promote democracy in other countries. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
When we think of democracy, we immediately consider concepts like freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom of religion, the Bill of Rights, basically. But what else is it that defines what a democracy is made up of?
Thank you very much. And I appreciate you using that phrase, imposing from the outside, because I will go about and give you some examples about the genuine homegrown democratic movements, particularly in the Middle East and North Africa. But let me first begin with answering your question in terms of what are the building blocks, what are the main ingredients, if you will. Now, this is by no means a complete or full list, but some of the main ingredients, if you will. Citizen participation. Very important, a part of us in strong civil society organizations. Rule of law, a respect for an independent judiciary, for example. Freedom of speech, just like you mentioned. Good governance, the idea of having legislatures that truly represent the aspirations and voices of people. Lack of corruption. Accountability, transparency, strong political parties that enter into elections and compete for rule, of course, but representing different ideologies, different point of views, freedom of the media, free and fair elections themselves, and of course, independent democratic trade unions that again represent working men and women. Civic education, very important, because one needs to understand not just what your rights are, but also what your duties and responsibilities. It's definitely a two-way street. Now, let me go back to this genuine, homegrown democratic movements, individuals, organizations, institutions in the Middle East and North Africa that exist and are flourishing. Many in the open, but also many also not in the open, and unfortunately underground or in secret or even in jails. Now, should we turn our backs to these hopes and aspirations and not support these movements? I would say absolutely not. Now, there are rulers in the region who recognize that democracy in one form or another is and are taking steps for progress. For example, in Bahrain, in Morocco, in Yemen, where there have been serious steps to move forward. The strategy at this point is to support that democratic middle, those Democrats, small d Democrats, who form that moderate political center. Likely the majority of the population in most Arab countries, but they've been deprived of a democratic middle ground that could offer that buffer between extremes of autocratic regimes on one side and religious extremists on the other. Now, knowing that there are indigenous, independent democratic forces that exist in the region, but they can't prosper. They need an environment. They need an environment where greater freedom and political speech is encouraged and rulers are held accountable. And so that's where the strategy emerges. So what is it? It's based on identifying, strengthening that moderate middle, those professionals, academics, women, students, businessmen and women, and if they're given a chance, could play a very central role in a democratic system, in the development of a democratic system. Let me give you an example. Last September in Morocco, there were elections. There were legislative elections. Today, we are happy to say that there are 35 women in the parliament today. They went from 2 to 35. Now, that's only half the battle. Now, those women need to caucus, need to work together, sometimes also need to work separately, but in order to advance their constituencies. We've had the great privilege to work with them to develop some training programs that help them meet their needs, not only to run for public office, but then to continue the job.
Well, let me ask you then about the influence of people from the outside, if you will. If you are encouraging them, providing training programs for them, that's one thing, but they can easily be portrayed then as, well, they're getting all this help from the outside. They're puppets of whomever.
But where do their ideas come from? Their ideas are their ideas. The programs, their needs are their needs. They're not needs from the outside. They're not needs imposed, not at all. They are genuine needs from within the country. And the trick, if you will, or the strategy, the cleverness in it, is then how to be able for us to ask the questions, and then for them to be able to answer, for us to provide the framework, if you will, so that international support is providing the framework, is asking the questions, and they, those indigenous, homegrown, inside the country, fill in the content. They provide the content.
How do you help encourage such growth and development? Is it just money?
Not at all. It's a whole host of things. Money plays a role, yes. However, being able to listen, being able to, again, provide that framework, being able to develop a network between Democrats, small-D Democrats from around the world that are willing and able to help each other, avoid some of the pitfalls. Because remember, many of the movements that are occurring today are, there are others that have been ahead of them and have been through this before and can help, can lend a helping hand.
Our telephone number again is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. We're talking about the principles of democracy, building institutions in a region that in many places has little familiarity with them. Our guest is Heba El Shazly, and our first caller is Maurice, who joins us on the line from Miami.
Yes, my question involves, you know, in many of these countries, such as Iraq, there seems to be a high rate of illiteracy. And it's hard to have an informed electorate in that case, and people don't have much to go on. Some are guided by religious principles, but I wanted to know how illiteracy might affect these choices.
Heba El Shazly, my understanding is that Iraq is not an illiterate society, in fact, a fairly well-educated society.
That is correct. That is my understanding as well. And let me also add that, if we're definitely speaking about the Arab world themselves and Arabs themselves have identified three major deficits. If you go back to the UNDP Human Development Report of last year, that report indicated three deficits, and they are, one, freedom. They themselves are saying that one of the major things that are lacking is freedom. Second, women's empowerment. Again, something that they themselves are asking for. And third, knowledge. So thank you to the caller. Knowledge is extremely important,
but
and is a deficit.
If it is not necessarily illiteracy, a tremendous problem in Iraq, it is in many other places.
That is correct. Yes, it is a problem in other countries. However, let me give you the example of Yemen. Yemen, there are many programs going on where they're using puppets, they're using art, they're using different mediums to, again, communicate what are the rights and duties and responsibilities of a citizen. So yes, literacy is important, but there are also other means.
Maurice?
Thank you very much. Yes, it's heartening to know that Iraq does have a high rate of literacy.
Yeah, it's a very well-educated country for the most part.
Yes.
Thanks very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Now, we're not talking about, as we look across the region, and your part of the world that you study, the Middle East and North Africa, there are many different forms of government, some of which have, if you looked on paper, the form of democracy. Egypt, for example, if you look at it, it looks like its constitution is that of a democracy, yet it isn't. How do you develop democratic institutions in autocratic countries where they may have political parties, but political freedom is very restricted?
It is very difficult. And however, I still maintain that there are movements, there are people, there are individuals, there are organizations, there are even institutions. The judiciary in Egypt is an institution that should be looked at again. It has played in the past an important role and is trying to safeguard its independence. There are judges who have been calling out and speaking out. It's not easy. It's not easy at all. And it takes time. This is not something that happens overnight. I think that perseverance and commitment and the courage of individuals and organizations in Egypt and in other countries is to be applauded and to be supported. Absolutely.
What would be the effect, and this is what the president was talking about in his speech at the American Enterprise Institute last week, of a model, if there is regime change in Baghdad, if a government there could be democratic, would that form a model for other countries to follow?
You're getting into some tricky territory here. Models. Some refer to it as recipes or a cookie cutter. Democracy is something that grows. It grows from the hopes and aspirations and desires of a people in a framework where there are laws and there is a respect for those laws. So models, we can use experiences, we can use history, we can use different countries from differing points of view. However, a model, it's difficult. I don't think one can take just a model and say, here, this, use this. I think you have to open it up for discussion, bring in a lot of different tools and experiences, have people discuss them and debate them and find what is most applicable and what is most workable for them as a nation and as a country. So that discussion in itself, that debate, that's citizen participation.
Well, many of the countries in the region have something along the lines of a majlis, some consultative process that is deeply rooted in tradition.
Very much so.
Is that something that can be built upon?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
How do you do that?
Let us examine. Let us examine, for example, how a tribe functions, the leader of the tribe, and the way he or she conduct a meeting, and they hold, and they use consensus, for example, and they discuss issues. And that is not just in the Arab culture, but in the African culture, in many others. So there's a lot to build upon. And again, as I mentioned earlier, let us build the framework, if you will, ask the questions, and then the homegrown indigenous movements again, they fill in the content because they know it much better than I do.
We only have about a minute or so in this segment, but how do you create the space for political trust? I mean, one of the difficulties of living in a democracy is if you don't win, you're afraid those other guys are going to trample your rights. How do you develop the trust that, well, you know, hey, we'll wait our turn, we'll get them next time?
Yes, we'll wait our turn and get them next time. That's why elections have to become a habit. That's why rule of law has to become a habit. The first time, it might not work as well and might not be 100% what we want, but then there will be a following time after that where we try again. So I think making it a habit is very important.
And the willingness not only to be elected and see other people elected, but then to transition power the next time when your guys lose, that's a key test, isn't it?
Absolutely.
We're talking about the values and institutions that make up a democracy. What values do you believe are central? Have you ever been involved in helping a country make the transition to democracy? If so, what were the problems? What were the frustrations? And what were the benefits? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. We'll be back after a break. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We're talking about the universal principles of democracy. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. What are those principles, and how can they take root in societies that may not have democratic traditions? You're invited to join our discussion. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Our guest here in Studio 3A is Heba El-Shazly, Deputy Regional Director at the National Democratic Institution for International Affairs. And let's go to the phones. Our next caller is Salam, who joins us on the line from Kansas City.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I would like to thank, first of all, our guest to explain the concept of democracy, because some people just realize that it's a sort of election. I mean, this is, as you said, it's a Bill of Rights. So, I really appreciate you explaining that to general public. I have a question, if she could make a comment on that. In Algeria, in the 90s, they had democratic elections, but they were overthrown by a military government. And unfortunately, the rest of the world did not comment on that. I mean, were they democratic elections or not? Thank you.
Thanks very much for the call, Salam. It's my recollection that the democratic elections were not held because the people who then took over the government feared that the wrong people were going to win. Is that right?
That's what actually the elections.
They were in a preliminary stage.
They were in a preliminary. Exactly. Let me first thank you, Salam, for your question, and it's a very important question, because that's something we hear many times. Well, what happens? What happens if we open? If you have an election today in the Middle East or North Africa, who's mm-hmm. going to win?
With Islamist-based
organizations and political parties. That is very correct. They are very well organized right now, and it is because there has been a vacuum again, that democratic middle, that center, and when you look at them and examine, they are well organized, they meet people's needs, they provide basic assistance, whether it's education, healthcare, they listen to people. Those major grievances that are not unfortunately being met by governments today, that gives them their strength.
A sense of legitimacy even in opposing the present government.
Yes, and what we're hoping for is that, again, that democratic middle that can speak to the needs and aspirations and the true grievances of people in the Arab world, and for it not to be determined by an autocrat on one side or a fundamentalist extremist on the other side.
Well, given the example of Algeria, where the elections were suspended,
yes, they were.
And a bloody civil war erupted, which continues to this day.
For 10 years or so.
And tens of thousands of people have been killed in the process.
Yes.
What went wrong?
You have to look at Algeria's history for the last 40 years. It was basically ruled, governed by one political party, by an autocratic political party. And many people say that vote back in 91-92 was basically a no vote. So let's try something new. And so who was well organized at the time? It was the extreme fundamentalists. Some didn't even vote. It was a very difficult time because, again, there were no alternatives. It was either voting back for that same regime, that one-party rule, or bringing in somebody new. And, hey, sometimes bringing in someone new, let's try a new mistake, if you will. Mm. So lack of education, lack of understanding about what the issues really are, lack of citizen participation, all of that lead to, unfortunately, some results that are not good for the whole populace, if you will. Mm.
Joining us now from his office in Belgrade is Serge Popovic. He was a leader of the resistance movement Otpor, which opposed the Milosevic regime. He's now a member of parliament in the newly formed government of Serbia-Montenegro. And welcome to Talk of the Nation, sir.
Good evening to you and NPR audience.
You were part of the movement that democratized Serbia. You're now part of the democracy. Is it what you imagined?
Well, it's not. It's very difficult to predict what may happen once you get to the public function, especially in a country left by the former regime in a very poor and difficult economic situation. So looking from here, it is a huge challenge to work in democracy building and establishing some roots from the position of government, which means the position of changing things in reality, but also from the position of responsibility coming from the people, you know, mm-hmm. elected you.
What are some of the most difficult challenges? I mean, I know in recent elections there's been a very low turnout, for example.
Well, there are some difficulties, of course, and if you look through the process, you can see that removing of the dictatorship and establishing a government, and we have very pro-democratic and radical reformistic government led by Mr. Zoran Djindjic, is not enough. You must look to the democracy building process as to the plan, where you have some basic levels and some advanced levels. And of course, we in Serbia achieved a huge effort and huge move in what is called basic level of democracy building, like building a little bit of democratic institutions or giving them credibility to work, having for the for real free and fair elections, free the media, make the autonomous university, and do those things which are necessary for a basic beginning, and, you know, putting your country on a list where basic human rights are supported. But you also must look to the part B of that plan, which is building the something which is installed a completely democratic society and has nothing to do with those basic principles. And then we can speak about the free market, freedom of choices, responsibility of people being in charge, and some other things. And at the end, you are going to meet the democratically rooted system in which you live.
Yeah, but getting to that end can sometimes be a very messy process. You have government officials who may not be used to being criticized, being lambasted in the press. You have demonstrations going on. You can have parties that finally work towards the great goal of compromise and achieving a final result, which can seemingly take forever. And then the courts say you can't do it. I mean, it's very frustrating sometimes.
I know, and it's happening to me, like you're expecting this. It seems like you're living in Serbia speaking about those stuff. Okay, but you know, the most important thing is that you make that huge society move, especially if you live in non-democratic and isolated society, living in a country which was under NATO attack, and living in a country where basic human or political rights weren't respected for years. And the key thing is to make this big rock moving in another direction, I mean, towards all those achievements of future democratic society. And if you look in 2 years period, before, where undemocratic government led by Hague imprisoner Milosevic was removed in a large demonstrations, but also after the elections, you can say that big rock is moving in a good direction, and you have like 2/3 of the people who really wants to become part of civilized world, and especially European Union. Well, looking to that process, you must think about that as a big rock. You must pushing and pushing and pushing, and there will be difficulties, and maybe sometimes you will feel like you're doing something wrong or you're moving in the wrong direction, but that wheel must resist to those temptations.
Along the way in the transition to democracy in Serbia, did you have the assistance of NGOs, like our guest here is from the National Democratic Institute for International Affairs? Was that helpful?
Yes, we have the help, especially coming from the different democracy development NGOs in the United States. I mean, actually, today I had a meeting with people coming from National Democratic Institute, which is huge NGO based there in Washington, D.C., in their governance program. And we want to cooperate, and we think that the transfer of knowledge coming from different countries is very important for democracy development. And we also are very interested in and actively trying to find the ways to share experience with other countries which passed the transition so we can avoid some mistakes.
Now, we happen to have caught you on a momentous day there. This is the inauguration day for the first parliament of the new country, Serbia-Montenegro. Yugoslavia no longer exists. Does the progression from a tyranny to a new republic surprise you, and does it make you proud?
Well, this makes me proud, in meaning that we were strong enough to finish that process in 2 years. I mean, the former Yugoslavia wasn't a living thing. It was a kind of bureaucratic agreement between two ruling parties. One of them was led by Milosevic. And Serbia and Montenegro is planned as a state which is going to sustain and which is going to become the member of Council of Europe this year and maybe be a candidate for association and stabilization pact with EU and negotiate with NATO and Partnership for Peace. And we have some serious plan down here. And this may be a very important day in our plans and in our future cooperation with the world.
On such a day, it's important to talk about the future, and those are pretty big ambitions. You're going to have to go a long way to achieve all those goals. And as you know, a lot of people say, you know, that constitution you guys just worked out with Montenegro allows either country to go its own way after 3 years. And a lot of people say it's not going to last longer than 3 years.
We are going to see that. If the economic interest and international interest of both Serbia and Montenegro is going to grow, we are not going to have that three-year predicted problem with going apart. I mean, it's in a mutual interest to come towards international institutions together, and I can see that partners from Montenegro are very aware of that fact, and they will compare it, you know. This is a very sensitive question. They should compare it with the political interest of the country and political support in Montenegro, which is deeply divided between two different lines, one of them wanting to live with Serbia in this type or another type of community, and another one wanting to try their way as independent country. But both those tendentions actually are very dependent on the situation we have with international institutions. And I will use this opportunity to repeat that we really need the support in our way, especially from the United States of America. And we are aware of the fact that there is a huge correlation between the destiny of a new state, Serbia and Montenegro, and progress we achieve in different international integration processes.
Thanks very much for speaking with us today. Sergio?
Yes.
Thanks very much. Appreciate it.
Hey, thank you and good night.
Okay. Good luck with your new parliament, by the way, and your new country.
Thank you.
Sergio Popovic is a member of parliament in the freshly minted state of Serbia, Montenegro, and he was speaking with us on the line from his home in Belgrade. And we have an email question that comes into us from Victor Menaldo. No one is saying that the people in the Middle East don't have hopes and aspirations. What the Bush administration is saying that it needs a catalyst which would start with the removal of Saddam Hussein. The German, Japanese, and Italian people had democratic aspirations also. However, it took the U.S. and its allies to defeat the tyrants that were sequestering homegrown and indigenous movements. Bush's plan is not incompatible with grassroots democratic movements. It is its only hope.
I'd like to actually focus on the wonderful word of persistence. Persistence. Let me tell you about my...
Could you just, before you get to persistence, you do us the favor of answering his comment or addressing his comment?
His comment being that...
That the removal of tyrants can make it possible for democratic institutions to flourish as they did in Germany, Italy, and in Japan after the Second World War.
I would say that is a possibility. However, again, let's look at the homegrown indigenous movements in those countries. Let's talk to the institutions, the civil society organizations.
And I think he's making a comparison to Iraq, which is basically, I think he's saying that it's not possible for those indigenous movements to develop under a dictatorship. That I guess he's drawing comparisons to the Axis powers during the Second World War, where they were similarly suppressed, and that perhaps the removal of the tyrant, whether by force if necessary, might create the conditions for those democratic institutions to thrive.
Well, I actually know of people who are in touch with individuals inside countries like Iraq, for example, where they are actively underground, quietly organizing. Mm-hmm. So that does exist. People have aspirations. As you said very, very correctly, these are universal principles, and they are shared by all, including by people in Iraq as well.
Mm-hmm. So persistence clearly necessary in a situation like Iraq when you have being watched by the secret police.
Absolutely. And let me also tell you about a good friend of ours who in Morocco has been running for public office since 1976. She's a pharmacist, and she made it. So since 1976.
That's the persistence you're talking about.
Yes.
Let us go to Hervé, I suppose that's called, and joins us on the line from Miami.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Okay, I live in Miami, but my question is the following. In a country like Haiti, where a democracy has just been introduced, isn't it necessary to be patient in order to see results? And also, should not it be necessary for outside government to sponsor parties that benefit them while destabilizing the elected government? And also, the last part of the question is that the people in Haiti, as far as I know, the majority of the people are willing to accept democracy in the country. But I think we need to understand the level of readiness. So we need to get them ready in order for them to accept and understand what is a democracy.
Mm-hmm. A complicated question. We just have a minute and a half for you to reply.
Very good point, and that's where civic education is very important, and the opportunities for citizens to come together, to meet, to discuss issues, and give their opinions is very important, and not only about their rights to understand those, but also their duties and responsibilities, as I mentioned earlier.
But patience, I guess that's the other side of persistence.
Absolutely.
Okay. Hervé, thanks very much for the phone call. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
We're talking about how to build and advance democratic values, practices, and institutions in the Middle East. Our telephone number, if you'd like to join the conversation, is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. You can also send us email. The address is totn@npr.org. We'll be back after a short break. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Today we're talking about whether and how democracy can take hold in the Middle East. What are the challenges and what are the influences of history, culture, and religion? Our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address, totn@npr.org. Our guest here in Studio 3A is Heba El Shazly. She's Deputy Regional Director at the National Democratic Institution for... first day back from vacation, I can barely talk. She is Deputy Regional Director at the National Democratic Institute for International Affairs. There, I got it out. And also here with us in Studio 3A is Samer Shahata, Acting Director of the Arab Studies Program at Georgetown University. Much easier to pronounce. Good to have you back on the program.
Thanks, Neil.
Wanted to bring you into the conversation, Samer. What are the prospects, in your view, of the vision that George Bush outlined last week at the speech at the American Enterprise Institute of regime change in Iraq being the engine of a democratic reform, not only in Iraq but throughout the region?
Well, slim to nil, really, in terms of how he outlined it last week at the American Enterprise Institute. I mean, I think many of us are incredibly skeptical about the possibility of a U.S.-imposed democracy in Iraq, certainly in the short term. And I think also many of us are quite cynical about the U.S.'s commitment to democracy, especially considering our track record, really, in terms of the lack of support for democracy and our support for authoritarian regimes. Really, in the Middle East since the end of World War II until the present. So skeptical and cynical, I think.
Wanted to get our listeners involved, but Heba El Shazly, did you have a comment on that?
I've been involved in this, or had the privilege to be involved in this kind of work for the last 15 years, and it's a long road. It's a very long road with a lot of bumps in the road, with sometimes you take two steps backwards in order to make one step forward. So
and the road may be mined.
Absolutely. So I know, and I don't please, and I don't mean to say this, Samer, but there are professional pessimists out there, and I guess I'm not party to them.
Let's get some listeners involved. Joe's on the line from Minneapolis.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, do your guests think that democracy could really have a foothold in an Islamic country? I mean, the only example we really have of one is Turkey. And ironically, it's been the military in Turkey that has kept a secular government. I mean, you know, let's face it, if there were democratic elections in many of these countries, I mean, look at Egypt, the type of government that would be elected would not be one that we'd want. It would be a fundamentalist government. So until Islamic society actually believes in a separation of church and state, in secular government, do they really think democracy has a foothold?
Sommer?
Yes, well, I certainly don't subscribe to the view that Islam is somehow incompatible with democracy or that the Arabs are predisposed to be authoritarian. I mean, I think that's nonsense for all kinds of reasons. Understanding what Islam is and so forth, not as a kind of monolithic entity, but as a living tradition, different ways to interpret Islam, different elements in Islam, like shura, consultation, ijtihad, interpretation, and so forth, that really could be the beginnings of democracy. So I certainly don't believe that democracy is somehow incompatible with Islam, or that Arabs particularly have a hard time with democratic principles. I think it's very possible, and my skepticism and cynicism isn't so much about the possibility of democracy in the Arab world. Not at all. I think we're just as capable of being democratic as anybody else. It's just that I'm skeptical that that the United States can impose democracy all at once in a short period of time, because as Hiba eloquently outlined earlier, democracy is a very difficult, ongoing process. And I'm also cynical about kind of our intentions, really, and what this whole democracy discourse is all about.
Yet one could also be cynical about these indigenous, homegrown institutions that have yet to produce a democracy.
Well, no, because there are people who are struggling daily for and putting their lives on the line for things like rule of law, independent judiciary, freedom of the press, people who have given up their lives in some cases. I mean, we see and we know about demonstrations, student movements, workers' movements, and so on. So I, too, believe that democracy, as Amartya Sen said, is a universal value, but I don't think that we can kind of, you know, put it in a day and a night and so forth, and the Iraqis will be democratic and that'll somehow spill over to the rest of the Arab world. I don't know what the mechanisms of that would be.
Thank you, Samer. Thank you. I couldn't have said it better, but absolutely. I can give you not stories, because they're real life cases of people I know personally, people I've heard of and had the privilege to work with, who day in and day out are running for public office, are running an advocacy campaign to support a law or a certain right for people in their respective countries, and so forth. So this is happening, whether we like it or not. Across the Atlantic, it is happening in the Middle East and North Africa, in every single country.
Joe, thanks very much for the call. Good question. Let's go now to Ray, and Ray's on the line with us from Fairfax, Virginia.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I would like to talk about a very specific point here. What's in the mind of the average citizen in the Arab street? In Iraq and outside Iraq, do they really desire democracy? Do they want democracy? Sure, yes, they do. Democracy is a human desire for people in the Middle East and people outside the Middle East. Now, are they having a good deal of rejection for democracy imposed by outside? Of course, yes. I am 36 years old. I lived 25 years of my life in the Middle East and the rest here in the United States, and I'm enjoying the American democracy. And I'm willing to live with the American democracy. I'm enjoying it. But not everybody in the Middle East had the chance to come here, to live here, and to know that this is a good way of living. So we have to understand when they want their democracy to be based on their tradition. Also, what's not helping us here as Americans to spread democracy in the Middle East is two very important points. The first point, that we have a very long history of dealing with regimes and governments that we call them now dictatorships, we call them now religious motivated governments. Those governments used to be our allies for long times. We helped creating, supporting, and at sometimes protecting those governments. Then all of a sudden September 11 comes and we know that this is not going to work. So we have to change those regimes. So we are putting the Arab average citizen in some confusion here. We helped those regimes, and now we want to change those regimes. This is number one.
Okay, Ray, I'm afraid I'm going to have to stop you at number one because we're running out of time, and I wanted to give Samer have a chance to respond. But thanks very much.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Sure. I think the first part of his both points really were very interesting. The first one about democracy with the big D and the Arab street and whether people really want it or not and so forth, whether they're thinking late at night, I want democracy in Cairo and Algiers. I think that the problem with that is that people really do want democracy, but we need to break democracy down. If we think of it in terms of what the principles of democracy are, accountability, transparency, and good governance, people don't want police officers pushing them around, or they want the provision of services, which is what good governance is about. So if we stop thinking in terms of the big D democracy, this kind of thing, and so on, a Western import, and we start looking at what it really means on a daily basis, then people do want democracy on the Arab street, and in the Arab basement, too.
How about 15 seconds for the last word?
Tolerance. Respect. Let's take that word democracy and really deconstruct it. And what does it mean to us in our day-to-day life? I agree with Samer. Let's talk about those basic principles again of respect and tolerance and participation. Very important.
Heba El Shazly is Deputy Regional Director for the Middle East and North Africa at the National Democratic Institute for International Affairs. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
And Samer Shahata is Acting Director of the Arab Studies Program at Georgetown University. He was with us here in 3A. Thanks very much for coming in, as always.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation, which is coming to you from National Public Radio News.